None of the boys want to take over the store.
Bonnie frowned. We've talked about that, Harmon. Why in the world should it bother us? They're free to do what they like.
Of course they are. But it would have been nice have at least one of them around.
This negativity of yours, it's driving me nuts.
Negativity?
I just wish you'd perk up.
She crumpled the donut bag closed.
And clean out those gutters. It isn't pleasant harm in having to feel like a nag.
By November, the leaves were gone. The trees along Main Street were bare, and the sky was often overcast. The shortening days made Harmon recall a soberness of heart that he had felt off and on for a long time. No wonder Bonnie had told him to perk up. In a small, private way, he was perking up, because now, as he went around closing up the store, selling nails to a last-minute customer, he found himself looking forward to his Sunday mornings with Daisy with a sense of gladness. Not the furtive urgency of those few months they'd been buddies. It was as though a light bulb glowed in a town where nighttime came swiftly, and sometimes driving home he would go the long way to pass by her house. Once he saw a dented Volvo parked in her driveway. It was covered with bumper stickers, and he wondered if some of Copper's family had come from Boston to visit. The next Sunday, Daisy said in a hushed tone at the door,
"Come in, Harmon. Have I got a story to tell you?"
She put a finger to her lips, then said,
"Nina's asleep upstairs in the little room."
They sat at the dining room table as Daisy told him in a whisper that the girl, a few days earlier, had had a fight with Tim. They'd been staying at some motel on Route 1 since getting kicked out of the Washburn place, and he'd gone off with their cell phone. Nina knocked on Daisy's door. So distraught, Daisy thought she might have to get her to a doctor. Nina got hold of the boy, though, and he'd come by to get her. Daisy thought they'd made up. But last night, the girl knocked again, another fight, and she didn't have a place to stay. So now she was upstairs. Daisy clasped her hands together on the table.
Boy, do I want a cigarette?
Harmon sat back.
Well, hold off if you can. We'll get this figured out.
Above them, the door creaked. There was a motion on the stairs, and here was the girl wearing flannel pants and a t-shirt.
Hello, said Harmon, so as not to frighten her, being startled himself.
He had not seen her for weeks since she'd been in the store. She was hardly recognizable. The girl's head seemed much too large for her body. Veins were visible on the sides of her forehead, and her bare arms were as skinny as the slats of the chair back she took hold of. He almost couldn't look.
Sit, dear, said Daisy.
The girl sat, her long, long arms placed on the table. Truly, it was as though a skeleton had sat down with them.
Did he call?
The girl asked Daisy. Her skin was not cinnamon-looking now, but pallid, and her hair, uncombed, looked like the hair of a stuffed animal, not real.
No, dear, he didn't.
Daisy handed her a tissue, and Harmon saw the girl was weeping.
What am I going to do?
She asked. She looked past Harmon, out the window at the road.
I mean, Victoria, of all people. Jesus, she was my friend.
You can stay another day while you get it figured out, said Daisy.
The girl turned her big light brown eyes toward Daisy, as though studying her from somewhere far off.
You should eat something, dear,
Daisy said. I know you don't want to, but you should.
She's right, Harmon said.
It worried him to think of this girl falling faint or dead in Daisy's little cottage. He thought of Bonnie saying how she had already damaged her heart.
Look, he pushed forward the two bags from the marina.
Donuts?
The girl eyed the bags.
Donuts?
How about just half a glass of milk and a bit of donut?
Daisy asked. The girl began to weep again. While Daisy went to get the milk, Harmon reached into his pocket and handed her his white folded handkerchief. The girl stopped crying, started to laugh.
Hey, cool, she said. I didn't know anyone used these anymore.
Go ahead and use it, Harmon said, but for the love of God, drink that milk.
Daisy brought in the milk, took the donut from its bag, broke it in two.
Fucking Luke, the girl said with sudden energy. He put me on fucking probation for being a muffin cutter.
A what? Asked Daisy, sitting down.
In the hospital, one time I cut my muffin in half. The rules are you're not supposed to engage. That's the word they use, engage, with the food, except to eat it. So I have this plastic knife in my pocket, and I cut the muffin in half, and I get reported to Luke. We heard you've been cutting your muffins, Nina, he said, with his arms folded across his chest.
The girl rolled her eyes extravagantly when she finished telling this.
Muffin Luke, the fucker.
Daisy and Harmon looked at each other.
How did you get out of the hospital? Asked Harmon.
I ran away. But next time my parents said they'll commit me and then I'm fucked.
Better eat the donut, Harmon said.
The girl giggled.
You're kind of goofy.
He's not goofy. He's concerned about you. Now, eat the donut, Daisy said in a melodious voice.
So, like, what's the story with you two?
The girl looked from one to the other.
We're friends, said Daisy, but Harmon saw that her cheeks colored. Okay.
Nina looked again from one to the other. Tears swelled in her eyes and spilled over.
I don't know what to do without Tim, she said, and I don't want to go back to the hospital.
She had begun to shiver. Harmon took off his big woolen cardigan and put it over her shoulders.
Of course you don't, said Daisy, but you need to eat. You're going to have other boyfriends, you know.
Harmon realized by a shift in the girl's expression that this was what she feared, being without love. Who didn't fear that? But he knew her problems had roots that were long and tangled, and the safety of Daisy's cottage could not provide any lasting relief. She was very sick.
How old are you?
He asked.
23. So you can't make me go to the hospital. I know this shit, she added, so don't try anything.
This is disc number 4.
How old are you?
He asked.
23. So you can't make me go to the hospital. I know this shit, she added, so don't try anything.
He held both palms toward her.
I am trying nothing.
He put his hands down.
Didn't you get arrested?
Nina nodded.
I had to show up in court. We both got ACDs, but I got an extra lecture because I'd been, you know, an asshole to that fucker police.
What's an ACD?
But Nina was exhausted. She folded her arms, putting her head down like he had seen her do in the marina that day. He and Daisy glanced at each other.
Nina,
he said softly, and she rolled her eyes toward him. He picked up the donut. He said,
To my memory, I have never begged for anything.
Just slightly, the girl smiled at him.
And I am begging you to eat.
The girl sat up slowly.
Only because you've been nice, she said.
She ate the donut so ravenously, Daisy had to tell her to slow down.
He stole from you, Nina said to Harmon with her mouth full. He stole some tubing that day to make a bong.
She lifted the glass of milk.
You're better off without him, Daisy said.
A loud knocking on the kitchen door caused them all to turn. The door opened, banged shut.
Hello,
The girl gave a whimper, spit the donut into Harmon's handkerchief, started to rise from her chair. Harmon's sweater fell from her shoulders to the floor.
No, dear.
Daisy put her hand on the girl's arm.
It's only a woman come to collect money for the Red Cross.
Olive Kitteridge stood in the doorway to the dining room, almost filling the space up.
Well, look at the tea party. Hello, Harmon.
To the girl.
Who are you?
The girl looked at Daisy, then at the table, her hand clenching the handkerchief. Looking back at Olive, she said sarcastically,
Who are you?
I'm Olive, said Olive, and if you don't mind, I'd like to sit down. Begging for money seems to knock me out. I think this is the last year I'll canvass.
Can I get you some coffee, Olive?
Nope, thank you.
Olive had gone round to the other side of the table, seated herself in a chair.
But that doughnut looks good. You have any more?
In fact, we do.
Daisy opened the other bag, glancing at Harmon. It was the doughnut meant for Bonnie, and pushed the paper bag toward Olive, the doughnut on it.
I could get you a plate.
Oh, hell no.
Olive ate the doughnut, leaning forward over the table. A silence fell.
Let me get you the check.
Daisy stood and went into the next room.
Henry okay? Harmon asked. Christopher?
Olive nodded, her mouth moving with the doughnut. Harmon knew, as most people in town did, that she didn't like her son's new wife. But then Harmon didn't think Olive would like any wife of her son. The new wife was a doctor, smart and from some city. He didn't remember where. Maybe she made baggies of granola, did yoga. He had no idea. Olive was watching Nina, and Harmon followed her gaze. Nina sat motionless, slumped forward, the back of each rib bone defined against her thin T-shirt. She clutched his handkerchief with a hand that looked like the claw of a seagull. Her head looked too big to be supported by the ridged stick of her backbone. The vein running from her hairline across to her brow was a greenish-blue color. Olive finished the doughnut, wiped the sugar from her fingers, sat back and said,
You're starving.
The girl didn't move, only said,
Duh.
I'm starving, too, Olive said.
The girl looked over at her.
I am, Olive said. Why do you think I eat every doughnut in sight?
You're not starving, Nina said with disgust.
Sure I am. We all are.
Wow,
Nina said quietly.
Heavy.
Olive looked through her big black handbag, took a tissue, wiped at her mouth, her forehead. It took a moment for Harmon to realize she was agitated. When Daisy returned and said,
Here you go, Olive,
slipping her an envelope, Olive only nodded, put it into her bag.
Jesus,
said Nina.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Olive Kitteridge was crying. If there was anyone in town Harmon believed he would never see cry, Olive was that person. But there she sat, large and big-wristed, her mouth quivering, tears coming from her eyes. She shook her head slightly as though to indicate the girl needn't apologize.
Excuse me,
she finally said, but she stayed where she was.
Olive, is there anything?
Daisy leaned forward. Olive shook her head again, blew her nose. She looked at Nina and said quietly,
I don't know who you are, but young lady, you're breaking my heart.
I'm not trying to, Nina said defensively. It's not like I can help it.
Oh, I know that. I know.
Olive nodded.
I taught school for 32 years. I never saw a girl sick like you. It wasn't around then, not up here anyway. But I know from all those years with kids and just living.
Olive stood up, wiped crumbs from her front.
Anyway, I'm sorry.
She started to move away, stopped when she was near the girl. Hesitantly, she raised her hand, started to put it down, then raised it again and touched the girl's head. She must have felt, beneath her large hand, something Harmon didn't see, because she slid her hand down to the girl's bone of a shoulder, and the girl, tears creeping from her closed eyes, leaned her cheek on Olive's hand.
"I don't want to be like this,"
the girl whispered.
"Of course you don't," said Olive. "And we're going to get you help."
The girl shook her head.
"They've tried. I just keep getting sick again. It's hopeless."
Olive reached and pulled over a chair so that she could sit with the girl's head on her big lap. She stroked the girl's hair and held a few pieces in her fingers, giving Daisy and Harmon a meaningful nod before flicking the hair to the floor. "You lost your hair when you starved." Olive had stopped her own weeping and said,
"Are you too young to know who Winston Churchill was?"
"I know who he was,"
the girl said tiredly.
"Well, he said, never, 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 never give up."
"He was fat," said Nina. "So what did he know?"
She added,
"It's not that I want to give up."
"Of course not," said Olive. "But your body's going to give up without some fuel. I know you've heard this all before, so you just lie there and don't answer. Well, answer this. Do you hate your mother?"
"No," Nina said. "I mean, she's kind of pathetic, but I don't hate her."
"All right, then," Olive said, her big body giving a shudder. "All right, then. That's a start."
For Harmon, the scene would always remind him of the day the ball of lightning came through the window and buzzed around, for there was a kind of warm electricity, something astonishing and unworldly in the feeling of the room as the girl began to cry, and Daisy eventually got the mother on the telephone, arrangements made for her to be picked up that afternoon, promises that she would not go to the hospital. Harmon left with Olive, the girl wrapped in a blanket on the couch. He helped Olive Kittredge get into her car. Then he walked back to the marina and went home, knowing that something in his life had changed. He did not speak of it to Bonnie.
"Did you bring me my donut?" she asked. "There was only cinnamon," he said. "The boys call?"
Bonnie shook her head. You started to expect things at a certain age. Harmon knew that. You worried about heart attacks, cancer, the cough that turned into a ferocious pneumonia. You could even expect to have a kind of midlife crisis. But there was nothing to explain what he felt was happening to him, that he'd been put into a transparent plastic capsule that rose off the ground and was tossed and blown and shaken so fiercely that he could not possibly find his way back to the quotidian pleasures of his past life. Desperately, he did not want this. And yet, after that morning at Daisy's, when Nina had cried and Daisy had gotten on the phone, making arrangements for the parents to come and get her, after that morning, the sight of Bonnie made him feel cold. The house felt like a damp, unlit cave. He noticed how Bonnie never asked him how things were at the store. Perhaps after all these years she didn't need to ask. Without wanting to, he began to keep score. A whole week might go by when she asked him nothing more personal than if he had any thoughts about dinner. One night he said,
"Bonnie, do you know my favorite song?"
She was reading and didn't look up.
"What?" "I said, do you know my favorite song?"
Now she looked at him over the tops of her glasses.
"And I said, what? What is it?" "So you don't know?"
She put her glasses onto her lap. "Am I supposed to know? Is this 20 questions?"
"I know yours, Some Enchanted Evening."
"Is that my favorite song? I didn't know."
"Isn't it?"
Bonnie shrugged, put her glasses back on, looked at her book.
I'm always chasing rainbows. Last time I checked, that was yours.
When would be the last time she checked? He barely remembered that song. He was going to say, no, it's Fools Rush In. But she turned the page, and he didn't say anything. On Sundays, he visited Daisy, sitting on the couch. They spoke frequently of Nina. She was in a program for eating disorders and having private psychotherapy and family therapy, too. Daisy was in touch with the girl by phone and frequently spoke to her mother. Talking all this over, it sometimes felt to Harmon that Nina was their child, his and Daisy's, that every aspect of her well-being was their great concern. When she gained weight, they broke a donut in half and touched it together as a toast.
To donut breakers, Harmon said, to Muffin Luke.
When he was in town, it seemed he saw couples everywhere, arms tucked against the other in sweet intimacy. He felt he saw light flash from their faces, and it was the light of life. People were living. How much longer would he live? In theory, he could live 20 more years, even 30, but he doubted that he would. And why would he want to, unless he was altogether healthy? Look at Wayne Root, only a couple years older than Harmon, and his wife had to tape a note to the television saying what day it was. Cliff Mott, just a ticking time bomb waiting to go off, all those arteries plugged. Harry Coombs had had a stiff neck and was dead from lymphoma by the end of last year.
What will you do for Thanksgiving? Harmon asked Daisy.
I'll go to my sister's. It'll be fine. And what about you? Will all the boys be home?
He shook his head.
We have to drive 3 hours to have it with Kevin's in-laws.
As it turned out, Derek didn't come, choosing to go to his girlfriend's instead. The other boys were there, but it wasn't their house, and seeing them was almost like visiting relatives, not sons.
Christmas will be better, Daisy promised.
She showed him a gift she was sending Nina, a pillow cross-stitched with the words, I am loved.
Don't you think that might help her to glance at that sometimes?
That's nice, Harmon said.
I spoke to Olive, and I'm signing the card from the three of us.
That's very nice, Daisy.
He asked Bonnie if she wanted to make popcorn balls for Christmas.
God in heaven, no, Bonnie said. Whenever your mother made those, I thought my teeth would come out.
For some reason, this made Harmon laugh, the long familiarity of his wife's voice. And when she laughed with him, he felt a splintering of love and comfort and pain spread through him. Derek came home for 2 days. He helped his father chop down a Christmas tree, helped him put it up, and then, the day after Christmas, he left to go skiing with some friends. Kevin was not as jovial as Harmon remembered him. He seemed grown up and serious, and maybe a little bit afraid of Martha, who wouldn't eat the carrot soup when she found it had been made with a chicken stock base. The other boys watched sports on television and went off to visit their girlfriends in towns far away. It occurred to Harmon it would be years before they had a house full of grandchildren. On New Year's, he and Bonnie were in bed by 10. He said,
I don't know, Bonnie. The holidays made me kind of blue this year.
She said,
well, the boys have grown up, Harmon. They have their own lives.
One afternoon at work, when the store was especially slow, he called Les Washburn and asked if the place he had rented to the Burnham boy was still empty. Les said it was. He wasn't renting to kids again. Tim Burnham had left town, which Harmon hadn't known.
Went off with a different girl. Not that pretty hellion who was sick. Before you rent it to anyone, Harmon said, just let me know, would you? I might be looking for a workspace.
Then, one day in January, when there had been one of those days of midwinter thaw, the snow melting for just a few moments, making the sidewalks wet and the fenders of cars sparkle, Daisy called him at the store.
"Can you stop by?"
she asked. Olive Kittredge's car was in Daisy's little driveway, and when he saw it, he knew. Inside, Daisy was crying and making tea, and Olive Kittredge was sitting at the table not crying, tapping a spoon against the table relentlessly.
"That goddamn know-it-all daughter-in-law of mine," she said. "To hear her talk, you'd think she was an expert on every goddamn thing." She said, "Olive, you couldn't really have expected her to get well. People with that disease never actually get over it." And I said to her, "Well, they don't all die, Suzanne." And she said, "Well, Olive, many of them actually do."
"The funeral's private," Daisy told Harmon. "Just the family."
He nodded.
"She was taking laxatives," Daisy said, putting a cup of tea in front of him, wiping at her nose with a tissue. "Her mother found them in a drawer in her room, and it made sense, I guess, because she'd stopped gaining the few ounces she'd been gaining, and so she went into the hospital on Thursday."
Here Daisy had to sit down and put her face into her hands.
"It was an awful scene," Olive told him, "from what the mother described. Nina didn't want to go, of course. They had to call people, get officials involved, and off she went kicking and biting."
"Poor little thing," said Daisy.
"She had the heart attack last night," Olive said to Harmon.
Olive shook her head, slapped lightly at the table with her hand.
"For the love of Jesus," she said.
It had been dark a long while by the time he left.
"Where in the world have you been?" Bonnie said. "Your supper's all cold."
He didn't answer, just sat down.
"I'm not that hungry, Bonnie. I'm sorry."
"You better tell me where you've been."
"Driving around," he said. "I told you, I've been kind of blue."
Bonnie sat down across from him.
"Your being so blue makes me feel awful, and I don't feel like feeling awful."
"I don't blame you," he said. "I'm sorry."
Kevin called him at the store a few mornings later.
"You busy, Dad? Got a minute?"
"What's up?"
"I just wanted to know if you're okay, if everything's okay."
Harmon watched Bessie Davis looking through the light bulbs.
"Sure, son. Why?"
"I was thinking you seemed a little depressed these days. Not yourself."
"No, no. Swimmingly, Kevin."
A phrase they'd used since Kevin had learned to swim late, when he was almost a teenager.
"Martha thinks you might be mad because of Christmas and the carrot soup."
"Oh, Jesus, no."
He saw Bessie turn, walk down toward the brooms.
"Is that what your mother said?"
"No one said anything. I was just wondering."
"Has your mother been complaining to you?"
"No, Dad. I just told you. It's me, wondering, that's all."
"Don't you worry," Harmon said. "I'm just fine. And you?"
"Swimmingly. Okay. Stay cool."
Bessie Davis, the town's old maid, stood and talked for a long time while she bought a new dustpan. She spoke of her hip problems, her bursitis. She spoke of her sister's thyroid condition.
"Hate this time of year,"
she said, shaking her head. Harmon felt a rush of anxiety as she left. Some skin that had stood between himself and the world seemed to have been ripped away, and everything was close and frightening. Bessie Davis had always talked on, but now he saw her loneliness as a lesion on her face. The words, "Not me, not me," crossed over his mind, and he pictured the sweet Nina White sitting on Tim Burnham's lap outside the marina, and he thought,
"Not you,
not you, not you."
On Sunday morning, the sky had a low overcast, and the lights in Daisy's living room glowed from beneath the little lampshades.
Daisy, I'm just going to say this. I don't want you to answer or in any way feel responsible. This is not because of anything you've done, except be you.
He waited, looked around the room, looked into her blue eyes and said,
I've fallen in love with you.
He felt so certain of what was coming, her kindness, her tender refusal, that he was amazed when he felt her soft arms around him, saw the tears in her eyes, felt her mouth on his. He paid the rent to Les Washburn from their savings account. How soon before Bonnie would notice, he couldn't say, but he thought he had a few months. What was he waiting for? The labor pains to squeeze so hard his new life would shoot forth? By February, as the slow opening of the world began once more, the air having a lightness of smell at times, the extra minutes of daylight as the sun lingered across a snow-covered field and made it violet in color, Harmon was afraid. What had begun, not when they were fuck buddies, but as a sweet interest in the other. Questions, probing the old memories, a shaft of love moving toward his heart, sharing the love and grief of Nina's brief life. All this was now, undeniably, a ferocious and full-blown love, and his heart itself seemed to know this. He thought it beat irregularly. Sitting in his lazy boy, he could hear it, feel it pulsing right behind his ribs. It seemed to be warning him in its heavy pounding that it would not be able to continue like this. Only the young, he thought, could withstand the rigors of love, except for little cinnamon-colored Nina. And it seemed all inside out, backward to forward, that he had been handed the baton by her. Never, never, never give up. He went to the doctor he'd known for years. The doctor stuck metal discs onto his bare chest, wires attached to each one. Harmon's heart showed no signs of trouble. As he sat in front of the doctor's big wooden desk, he told the man he perhaps was going to leave his marriage. The doctor said quietly,
"No, no, this is no good."
But it was the doctor's body. The sudden way he moved the folders on his desk, the way he moved back from Harmon that Harmon would always remember, as though he had known what Harmon didn't know, that lives get knit together like bones and fractures might not heal. But there was no telling Harmon anything. There is no telling anyone anything when they have been infected this way. He was waiting now. Living in the hallucinatory world of Daisy Foster's generous body, waiting for the day, and he knew it would come, when he left Bonnie, or when she kicked him out. He didn't know which of the two would happen, but it would. Waiting like Muffin Luke for open-heart surgery, not knowing if he would die on the table or live. A Different Road. An awful thing happened to the Kittredges on a chilly night in June. At the time, Henry was 68, Olive 69, and while they were not an especially youthful couple, there was nothing about them that gave the appearance of being old or ill. Still, after a year had gone by, people in this small New England coastal town of Crosby agreed. Both Kittredges were changed by the event. Henry, if you met him at the post office now, only lifted his mail as a hello. When you looked into his eyes, it was like seeing him through a screened-in porch. Sad, because he had always been an open-faced and cheerful man, even when his only son had, out of the blue, moved to California with his new wife, something people in town understood had been a great disappointment for the Kittredges. And while Olive Kittredge had never, in anyone's memory, felt inclined to be affable or even polite, she seemed less so now as this particular June rolled around. Not a chilly June this year, but one that showed up with the suddenness of summer, days of dappled sunlight falling through the birch trees, making the people of Crosby uncharacteristically chatty at times. Why else would Cynthia Bibber have approached Olive in the shopping mall out at Cook's Corner to explain how Cynthia's daughter, Andrea, who after years of evening classes had earned a social work degree, thought maybe Henry and Olive hadn't been able to absorb the experience they'd had last year? Panic, when it wasn't expressed, became internalized. And that, Cynthia Bibber was saying, in an earnest half-whisper as she stood next to a plastic ficus tree, could lead to a depressive situation.
"I see," said Olive loudly. "Well, you tell Andrea. That's pretty impressive."
Olive, years ago, had taught math at the Crosby Junior High School, and while her emotions at times had attached themselves fiercely to particular students, Andrea Bibber had never seemed to her to be anything more than a small, dull, asseverating mouse. Like her mother, Olive thought, glancing past her at the silk daffodils that were stuck in rows of fake straw by the benches near the frozen yogurt place.
"It's a specialty now," Cynthia Bibber was saying.
"What is?" asked Olive, considering the possibility of some frozen chocolate yogurt if this woman would move on.
"Crisis counseling," said Cynthia, "even before 9/11.
She shifted a package under her arm. "But when there's a crash or a school shooting or anything nowadays, they bring in psychologists right off the bat. People can't process this stuff on their own."
"Huh."
Olive glanced down at the woman, who was short and small-boned. Olive, big, solidly built, towered over her.
"People have noticed a change in Henry," Cynthia said, "and you too. And it's just a thought that crisis counseling might have helped, could still help. Andrea has her own practice, you know, gone in with another woman part-time."
"I see," said Olive again, quite loudly this time.
"Aren't they ugly words, Cynthia, that those people think up? Process, internalized, depressive, whatever. It'd make me depressive to go around saying those words all day."
She held up the plastic bag she carried.
"Do you see the sale they're having at Sofro?"
In the parking lot, she couldn't find her keys and had to dump the contents of her pocketbook out onto the sun-baked hood of the car. At the stop sign, she said,
"Oh, hell's bells to you,"
into the rearview mirror, when a man in a red truck honked his horn. Then she pulled into traffic, and the bag from the fabric store slid onto the floor, a corner of denim material poking out onto the gravelly mat.
"Andrea Bibber wants us to make an appointment for crisis counseling,"
she'd have said in the old days, and it was easy to picture Henry's big eyebrows drawing together as he stood up from weeding the peas.
"Godfrey, Ollie,"
he'd have answered, the bays spread out behind him and seagulls flapping their wings above a lobster boat.
"Imagine."
He might even have put his head back to laugh the way he did sometimes. It would have been that funny. Olive merged onto the highway, which was how she'd gotten home from the mall ever since Christopher had moved to California. She didn't care to drive by the house with its lovely lines and the big bowed window where the Boston fern had done so well. Out here by Cook's Corner, the highway went along the river, and today the water was shimmery and the leaves of poplars fluttered, showing the paler green of their undersides. Maybe even in the old days, Henry wouldn't have laughed about Andrea Bibber. You could be wrong thinking you knew what people would do.
"Bet you anything," Olive said out loud as she looked over at the shining river, the sweet ribbon of it there beyond the guardrails.
What she meant was, "Bet you anything Andrea Bibber has a different idea of crisis than I do."
"Yup, yup," she said.
Weeping willows were down there on the bank, their swooping airy boughs a light, bright green. She had needed to go to the bathroom.
"I need to go to the bathroom,"
she had said to Henry that night as they were pulling into the town of Maisie Mills. Henry had told her, pleasantly, she'd have to wait.
Aye,
she had said, pronouncing the word with exaggeration in order to make fun of her mother-in-law, Pauline, dead for some years, who used to say that in response to anything she didn't want to hear.
Aye,
Olive had repeated.
Tell my insides,
she added, shifting slightly in the darkened car.
Good Lord, Henry, I'm about ready to explode.
But the truth was, they had had a pleasant evening. Earlier, farther up the river, they had met their friends Bill and Bunny Newton, and had gone to a restaurant recently opened, enjoying themselves a good deal. The mushrooms stuffed with crab meat were marvelous, and all evening the waiters bowed politely, filling water glasses before the water had gone halfway down. More gratifying, however, was the fact that for Olive and Henry, the story of Bill and Bunny's offspring was worse than their own. Both couples had only the one child, and Karen Newton, the Kittredges privately agreed, had created a different level of sadness for her parents. Even if Karen did live next door to Bill and Bunny, and they got to see her and her family all the time. Last year, Karen had carried on a brief affair with a man who worked for Midcoast Power, but decided in the end to stay in her marriage. All this, of course, worried the Newtons profoundly, even though they had never cared a great deal for their son-in-law, Eddie. And while it had been a really ghastly blow for the Kittredges to have Christopher so suddenly uprooted by his pushy new wife, after they had planned on him living nearby and raising a family, Olive had pictured teaching his future children how to plant bulbs. While it had certainly been a blow to have this dream disintegrate, the fact that Bill and Bunny had their grandchildren right next door and the grandchildren were spiteful was a source of unspoken comfort to the Kittredges. In fact, the Newtons told a story that night about how their grandson had said to Bunny just last week, "You may be my grandmother, but that doesn't mean I have to love you, you know." It was a frightful thing. Who would expect such a thing? Bunny's eyes had glistened in the telling of this. Olive and Henry did what they could, shaking their heads, saying what a shame it was that Eddie essentially trained the children to say these things under the guise of expressing themselves.
"Well, Karen's responsible, too,"
Bill said gravely, and Olive and Henry murmured, "Well, sure, that was true."
"Oh, boy," said Bunny, blowing her nose. "Sometimes it seems like you can't win."
"You can't win," Henry said. "You do your best."
How was the California contingent, Bill wanted to know.
"Grumpy," Olive said. "Grumpy as hell when we called last week. I told Henry, we're going to stop calling. When they feel like speaking to us, we'll speak to them."
"You can't win," said Bunny, "even when you do your best."
But they had been able to laugh as if something about it were ruefully funny. Always nice to hear other people's problems, Olive and Bunny had agreed in the parking lot, pulling on their sweaters. It was chilly in the car. Henry said they could turn the heat on if she wanted, but she said no. They drove along through the dark, an occasional car coming toward them with headlights shining, then the road dark again.
"Awful what that boy said to Bunny," Olive remarked, and Henry said it was awful.
After a while, Henry said,
"That Karen's not much."
"No,"
Olive said, "she's not." But her stomach, grumbling and shifting in familiar ways, began some acceleration of its own, and Olive became alert, then alarmed.
"God,"
she said as they stopped for a red light by the bridge that crossed into the town of Maisie Mills.
"I really am ready to explode."
"I'm not sure what to do,"
Henry said, leaning forward to peer through the windshield.
"The gas stations are across town, and who knows if they're open at this hour. Can't you sit tight?" We'll be home in 15 minutes.
No, said Olive. Believe me, I'm sitting as tight as I can.
Well?
Green, go. Pull into the hospital, Henry. They ought to have a bathroom.
The hospital? Ollie, I don't know.
Turn into the hospital, for crying out loud, she added. I was born there. I guess they'll let me use a bathroom.
There was the hospital at the top of the hill, bigger now with the new wing that had been built. Henry turned the car in and then drove right past the blue sign that spelled out emergency.
What are you doing? Asked Olive. For God's sake!
I'm taking you around to the front door.
Stop the goddamn car!
Oh, Olive.
His voice was filled with disappointment, she supposed, because of how he hated to have her swear. He backed the car up and stopped in front of the big, well-lighted blue door that said emergency.
Thank you, said Olive. Now was that so hard to do?
The nurse had looked up from her desk in a lobby cleanly bright and empty.
I need a bathroom, Olive said, and the nurse raised her white sweatered arm and pointed.
Olive waved her hand over her head and stepped through the door.
Whew,
she said to herself out loud.
Woo-wee.
Pleasure is the absence of pain, according to Aristotle, or Plato, one of them. Olive had graduated magna cum laude from college, and Henry's mother had actually not liked that. Imagine. Pauline had actually said something about magna cum laude girls being plain and not having much fun. Well, Olive was not going to spoil this moment thinking of Pauline. She finished up, washed her hands, and looked around as she stuck them under the dryer, thinking how the bathroom was huge, big enough to do surgery in. It was because of people in wheelchairs. Nowadays you got sued if you didn't build something big enough for a wheelchair, but she'd rather somebody just shoot her if it came to that. You all right? The nurse was standing in the hallway, her sweater and pants droopy.
What'd you have? Diarrhea?
Explosive, said Olive. My goodness. I'm fine now, thank you very much.
Vomiting?
Oh, no.
Do you have any allergies?
Nope. Olive looked around. You seem pretty short on business tonight.
Well, weekends it picks up.
Olive nodded.
People party, I suppose. Drive into a tree.
More often than not, the nurse said. It's families. Last Friday we had a brother push his sister out the window. They were afraid she broke her neck.
My word, said Olive. All this in little Maisie Mills?
She was okay. I think the doctor's ready to see you now.
Oh, I don't need a doctor. I needed a bathroom. We had dinner with friends, and I ate everything came my way. My husband's waiting for me in the parking lot.
The nurse reached for Olive's hand and looked at it.
Let's just be careful for a minute here. Have your palms been itching? Soles of your feet?
She peered up at Olive.
Are your ears always this red?
Olive touched her ears.
Why? She said. Am I getting ready to die?
Lost a woman in here just last night, the nurse said. About your age. Like you, she'd been out to eat with her husband and came in here later with diarrhea.
Oh, for God's sake, Olive said,
but her heart banged fast and her face heated up.
What in hell ailed her?
She was allergic to crab meat and went into anaphylactic shock.
Well, there you are. I'm not allergic to crab meat.
The nurse nodded calmly.
This woman'd been eating it for years with no problem. Let's just have the doctor give you a look. You did come in here flushed, showing signs of agitation.
Olive felt a great deal more agitated now, but she wasn't going to let the nurse know that, nor was she going to mention to her the mushrooms stuffed with crab meat. If the doctor was nice, she'd tell him. Henry was parked straight in front of the emergency room with the engine still running. She gestured for him to put the window down.
"They want to check me," she said, bending her head down. "Check you in?" "Check me. Make sure I haven't gone into shock. Turn that damn thing down."
Although he had already reached over to turn off the Red Sox game.
"Ollie, good Lord, are you all right? Some woman choked on crab meat last night, and now they're afraid they'll be sued. They're going to check my pulse, and I'll be right out. But you ought to move the car."
The nurse was holding back a huge green curtain farther down the hall.
"He's listening to the ball game," Olive said, walking toward her. "When he thinks I've died, I expect he'll come in."
"I'll keep an eye out for him."
"He's got on a red jacket."
Olive put her pocketbook on a nearby chair and then sat on the examining table while the nurse took her blood pressure.
"Better safe than sorry," the nurse said, "but I expect you're all right."
"I expect I am," said Olive.
The nurse left her with a form on a clipboard, and Olive sat on the examining table filling it out. She looked closely at her palms and set the clipboard aside.
"Well, if you came stumbling into an emergency room, it was their job to examine you. She'd stick her tongue out, have her temperature taken, go home." "Mrs. Kittredge?"
The doctor was a plain-faced man who did not appear old enough to have gone through medical school. He held her large wrist gently, taking her pulse, while she told him about going to the new restaurant and that she'd only come in here to use the bathroom on the drive home. And yes, she'd had some terrific diarrhea, which had surprised her, but no itchy hands or feet.
"What did you have to eat?"
the doctor asked, as though he were interested.
"I started off with mushrooms stuffed with crab meat, and I know some old lady died from that last night."
The doctor touched Olive's earlobe, squinting.
"I don't see any signs of a rash," he said. "Tell me what else you had to eat."
She appreciated how this young man did not seem bored. So many doctors made you feel like hell, like you were just a fat lump moving down the conveyor belt.
"Steak and a potato, baked, big as your hat, and creamed spinach. Let's see."
Olive closed her eyes.
"Puny little salad, but a nice dressing on it. Soup. A lot of additives in soup that can cause allergic reactions." "No soup," Olive said, opening her eyes, "but a lovely slab of cheesecake for dessert with strawberries."
The doctor said as he wrote things down,
"This is probably just a case of active gastroreflux." "Oh, I see," said Olive.
She considered for a moment before adding quickly,
"Statistically speaking, it doesn't seem you'd have two women die of the same thing two nights in a row." "I think you're okay," the doctor said, "but I'd like to examine you just the same, palpate your abdomen, listen to your heart."
He handed her a blue, papery plastic square.
"Put this on, open in front. Everything off, please." "Oh, for heaven's sake," said Olive,
but he had already stepped past the curtain.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," she said again,
rolling her eyes. But she did as she was told, because he had been pleasant, and because the crab meat woman had died. Olive folded her slacks and put them on the chair, careful to tuck her underpants beneath them where they couldn't be seen when the doctor walked back in. Silly little plastic belt made for a skinny pinny. It could barely tie around her. She managed, though, a tiny white bow. Waiting, she folded her hands and realized how every single time she went by this hospital, the same two thoughts occurred to her, which is that she'd been born here and that her father's body had been brought here after his suicide. She'd been through some things, but never mind. She straightened her back. Other people had been through things, too. She gave a small shake of her head as she thought of the nurse saying someone had tossed his sister out the window like that. If Christopher had had a sister, he never would have thrown her out a window. If Christopher had married his receptionist, he'd still be here in town, although the girl had been stupid. Olive could see why he'd passed on her. His wife was not stupid. She was pushy and determined and mean as a bat from hell. Olive straightened her back and looked at the little glass bottles of different things lined up on the counter and the box of latex gloves. In the drawers of that metal cabinet, she bet there were all sorts of syringes ready for all sorts of problems. She flexed her ankle one way, then the other. In a minute, she was going to poke her nose out to see if Henry was all set. She knew he wouldn't stay out there in the car, even with the ball game on. She'd call Bunny tomorrow, tell her about this little fiasco. After that, it was like painting with a sponge, like someone had pressed a paint-wet sponge to the inside of her mind, and only what it painted, those splotches there, held what she remembered of the rest of that night. There was a quick rushing sound, the curtain flung back with the tinny whoosh of its rings against the rod. There was a person in a blue ski mask waving an arm at Olive, shouting, "Get down!" There was the weird confusion. For a second, the schoolteacher in her saying, "Hey, hey, hey," while he said, "Get down, lady! Jesus!" "Get down where?" she might have said, because they were both confused. She was sure of that. She, clutching her papery robe, and this slender person in a blue ski mask waving his arm. "Look," she did say, her tongue as sticky as flypaper. "My handbag is right on that chair." But there was a shout from down the hall, a man shouting, coming closer, and it was the quick thrust of a booted foot kicking over the chair that swept her into the black of terror. A tall man holding a rifle, wearing a big khaki vest with pocket flaps. But it was the mask he wore, a Halloween mask of a pink-cheeked smiling pig, which seemed to pitch her forward into the depths of ice-cold water, that ghoulish plastic face of a pink smiling pig. Underwater, she saw the seaweed of his camouflage pants and knew he was shouting at her, but couldn't hear his words. They made her walk down the hall in her bare feet and papery blue robe while they walked behind her. Her legs ached and felt enormous, like big sacks of water. A shove behind smacked into her, and she stumbled, clutching her papery robe as she was pushed through the door of the bathroom she had been in. On the floor, with their backs against the separate walls, sat the nurse and the doctor and Henry. Henry's red jacket was unzipped and askew, one of his pant legs caught halfway up.
"Olive, have they hurt you?"
"Shut the fuck up," said the man with the smiling pink pig face,
and he kicked Henry's foot.
"Say another word, and I'll blow your motherfucking head off right now."
A paint splotch of memory that quivered every time. The sound of the duct tape behind her that night, the quick stripping of duct tape from its roll, and the grabbing of her hands behind her back, the wrapping of the tape around them, because then she knew she was going to die, that they would, all of them, be shot execution style. They would have to kneel. She was told to sit. But it was hard to sit down when your hands were taped behind you and your head inside was tilting. She had thought, just hurry. Her legs were shaking so hard, they actually made a little slapping sound against the floor.
"Move, you get shot in the head,"
Pigface said. He was holding the rifle, and he kept turning quickly while the flaps of his vest bulged, swinging when he turned.
"You even look at each other, and this guy shoots you in the head."
But when did the things get said? Different things got said. Along the exit ramp now were lilac trees and a red berry bush. Olive pulled up at the stop sign, and then almost pulled out in front of a car passing by. Even as she looked at the car, she almost pulled out in front of it. The driver shook his head at her as though she were crazy.
Hell's bells to you, she said,
but she waited so she wouldn't end up right behind someone who had just looked at her as though she were crazy, and then she decided to go in the other direction, heading the back way to Maisie Mills. Pigface had left them in the bathroom. It just doesn't make sense, different people said to the Kittredges soon after this happened, after they read about it in the paper, saw it on TV. It doesn't make sense, two fellows barging into a hospital hoping to get drugs. Before people realized, the Kittredges were not going to say three words about the ordeal. What does making sense have to do with the price of eggs, Olive could have said. Pigface had left them, and Blue Mask reached for the doorknob, locking it with the same click sound it had made for Olive not so long before. He sat down on the toilet seat cover, leaning forward, his legs apart, a small, squarish gun in his hand. Made of pewter, it looked like. Olive had thought she would vomit and choke on the vomit. It seemed a certainty. Being unable to move her bulky, handless self, she would aspirate the vomit that was on its way up, and she would do it sitting right next to a doctor who wouldn't be able to help her, because his hands were taped too. Sitting next to a doctor and across from a nurse, she would die on her vomit the way drunks did, and Henry would watch it and never be the same. People have noticed the change in Henry. She didn't vomit. The nurse had been crying when Olive was first pushed into the bathroom, and she was still crying. A lot of things were the nurse's fault. At some point, the doctor, whose white lab coat had been partly bunched beneath his leg that was closest to Olive, had said, "What's your name?" using the same pleasant voice he'd used earlier with Olive.
"Listen," said Blue Mask. "Fuck you, okay?"
At different times, Olive thought, I remember this clearly, but then, later, couldn't remember when she'd thought that. Paint streaks, though, of this. They were quiet. They were waiting. Her legs had stopped shaking. Outside the door, a telephone rang. It rang and rang, then stopped. Almost immediately, it rang again. Olive's kneecaps bumped up like big uneven saucers beyond the edge of the papery blue robe. She didn't think she would have picked them out as her own if someone had passed before her a series of photographs of old ladies' fat knees. Her ankles and bunioned toes seemed more familiar, stuck out in the middle of the room. The doctor's legs were not as long as hers, and his shoes didn't seem very big. Plain as a child's, his shoes, brown leather and rubber-soled. Where Henry's pant leg was caught up, the liver spot showed on his white, hairless shin. He said,
"Oh, gosh,"
quietly, and then,
"Do you think you could find a blanket for my wife? Her teeth are chattering." "You think this is a fucking hotel?" said Blue Mask. "Just shut the fuck up." "But she's..." "Henry?" Olive said sharply. "Be quiet."
The nurse kept crying silently. No, Olive could not get the splotches arranged in order, but Blue Mask was very nervous. She understood early on he was frightened to death. He kept bouncing his knees up and down. Young, she had understood that right away, too. When he pushed up the sleeves of his nylon jacket, his wrists were moist with perspiration. And then she saw how he had almost no fingernails. She had never, in all her years of school teaching, come across nails that had been bitten so extremely to the quick. He kept bringing his fingertips to his mouth, pressing them into the slots of the mask with a ferociousness. Even the hand that held the gun would move to his mouth, and he would chew the thumb tip quickly, a big bump of bright red.
"Get your fucking head down," he said to Henry. "Stop fucking watching me." "You don't need to speak so filthy," Henry said, looking at the floor, his wavy hair headed in the wrong direction across his head. "What'd you say?"
The boy's voice rose like it was going to break.
"What the fuck did you say, old man?"
"Henry, please," Olive said,
keep quiet before you get us all killed.
This, blue mask leaning forward, interested in Henry.
Old man, what the fucking fuck did you say to me?
Henry turning his face to the side, his big eyebrows frowning, blue mask getting up and pushing the gun into Henry's shoulder.
Answer me! What the fuck did you say to me?
And Olive, turning down past the mill now, approaching the town, remembered the familiarity of that kind of frenzied frustration, saying to Christopher when he was a child,
Answer me!
Christopher, always a quiet child, quiet the way her father had been. Henry blurted,
I said you don't need to talk so filthy.
Blurted out further,
You should be ashamed of your mouth.
And then the guy had pushed the gun against Henry's face, right into his cheek, his hand on the trigger.
Please! Olive cried out. Please! He got that from his mother. His mother was impossible. Just ignore him.
Her heart thumped so hard she thought it made her papery blue gown move on her chest. The boy stood there watching Henry, then finally stepped back, tripping over the nurse's white shoes. He kept the gun pointed at Henry, but turned to look at Olive.
This guy's your husband?
Olive nodded.
Well, he's a fucking nut.
He can't help it, Olive said. You'd have to know his mother. His mother was full of pious crap.
That's not true, said Henry. My mother was a good, decent woman.
Shut up, the boy said tiredly.
Everyone, please, just shut the fuck up.
He sat back down on the toilet seat cover, his legs spread, holding the gun over a knee. Olive's mouth was so dry, she thought of the word tongue and pictured a slab of cow's tongue packaged for sale. The boy suddenly pulled off his ski mask, and how startling. It was as though she knew him then, as if seeing him made sense. Quietly, he said,
Motherfucker.
His skin had become tender beneath the heat of the ski mask. His neck had streaks, patches of red. Crowded together, high on his cheeks were inflamed pimples. His head was shaved, but she saw he was a redhead. There was the orangey effervescence of his scalp, the tiny flickers of bright stubble, the almost parboiled look of his tender, pale skin. The boy wiped his face in the crook of his nylon-sleeved elbow.
I bought my son a ski mask like that, Olive told him. He lives in California and skis in the Sierra Nevada mountains.
The boy looked at her. His eyes were pale blue and his eyelashes were almost colorless. The whites of his eyes had spidery red veins. He kept staring at Olive without changing his hangdog expression.
Just please shut up,
he finally said. Olive sat in her car in the far back of the hospital's parking lot, where she could see the blue door of the emergency room, but there was no shade, and the sun baked through the windshield. Even with the windows open, she was too warm. The lack of shade had not been a problem all year, of course. In the winter, she would come and sit with the car running. Never did she stay long. Only enough to gaze at the door and to remember the clean, bright lobby, the huge bathroom with its shiny chrome rail that ran along part of one wall, a rail that right now, perhaps, some old doddering lady was holding on to in order to hoist herself off the toilet. The rail Olive had stared at as they all sat, legs splayed out, hands behind their backs. In hospitals, lives were changed all the time. A newspaper said the nurse had not returned to work, but maybe by now she had. About the doctor, Olive didn't know. The kid kept getting up and sitting back down on the toilet seat. When he sat, he'd be hunched forward, the gun in one hand, the other hand folded in front of his mouth, him chewing the hell out of those fingertips. The sirens did not sound for very long, she had thought that, but maybe they had sounded for a long time. It was the pharmacist who'd been able to signal a janitor to call the police, a special unit brought to negotiate with Pigface. But none of them had known that then. A telephone kept ringing and stopping. They waited, the nurse rolling her head back, closing her eyes. Olive's little plastic strip of a belt had come untied. The memory of this was a splotch of thick, dense paint. The belt, somewhere along the line, had come untied, and the papery gown was open. She tried crossing one leg over the other, but that made the gown open more, and she could see her big stomach with its folds, and her thighs, white as two massive fish bellies.
"Honestly," Henry said, "can't you find something to cover my wife? She's all exposed."
"Shut up, Henry," Olive said.
The nurse opened her eyes and gazed over at Olive, and the doctor, of course, turned his head to look at her. They were all looking at her now.
"God, Henry!"
The boy leaned forward and said softly to Henry,
"See, you gotta be quiet, or someone's gonna blow your head off. Your motherfucking head," he added.
He sat back. His glance, as he looked around, fell on Olive, and he said,
"Oh, Jesus, lady."
A look of real discomfort passing over his face.